to Ghoulish Tendencies. I'm Gabby.
And I'm Kim, and we are two paranormal investigators who delve into the depths of the famous and not so famous cases
of Moida ghosts, legends, and lore with a healthy dose of debunking.
Indeed.
Debunking, indeed.
We'll be doing some debunking today.
Ooh, debunking donuts. Can't wait.
Debunking donuts. You know what time it is?
5:55.
No. Gabby. It's movie curse time, Gabby. It's movie curse time.
Oh, I thought you were asking for the literal time.
No, well, we are recording earlier than normal.
We are.
So if you hear more sirens in the background, that's why.
Or dog barking.
The
struggle's real.
No, it's movie curse time. Yes. You know I love a good movie curse.
Our audience loves a good movie curse.
They do. They do. And it's been a hot second. We haven't done a curse since the Superman one.
Superman. Yeah, I was going to say.
Wasn't technically movie curse. It was just like Superman curse. But we get requests for movie curses.
We do.
And I feel like today's is kind of cool because it's not a horror film.
Oh.
Yeah.
That is kind of cool. What is it? I'm excited.
We're going to be talking about the allegedly cursed Rebel Without a Cause.
Oh, I've heard about that. Oh, I'm excited. I haven't seen that in so long.
I was going to ask if you'd ever seen Rebel Without a Cause.
Yes, a very, 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 very long time ago, to the point where I'm like, I don't remember when it was. All I remember is that it was shot at Griffith Observatory in LA.
Oh, yeah.
Which I'm currently in Los Angeles, and I have been there many a time.
Oh, so it's funny. I'm going to be honest. I had not seen it.
Really?
I'd seen parts from it before. Huh. Like some of the more famous scenes I had seen, but I'd never watched it start to finish. So in preparation, I did watch it.
Good job.
It is considered by some to be the best movie ever made about teens and teen angst. It was made in 1955, so
pretty emo.
Some things have changed, but there are some themes that I think were universal, and there's some things that have held up. I do want to give a very quick content warning. A couple of the deaths we are going to be talking about are deaths by suicide. Now, we are not talking in any graphic details. I'm not even going to be giving that many details, but I just want to make sure listeners know going in.
Thank you.
So yes, Rebel Without a Cause, for my friends at home who have never seen it. It is about teenagers. We start on Jim Stark, famously portrayed by James Dean, and he is being arrested for drinking, and he is taken to jail. And in jail, he meets John Plato Crawford, played by Sal Mineo, and Judy, played by Natalie Wood. And they all have your various teen problems at home. They talk about this with the officers. There's a lot of shenanigans just about teens being angsty teens, and my parents don't understand me. And gangs, but like 1950 greaser gangs.
Like West Side Story action?
West Side Story, like car racing gangs, like... Not quite what we think of most of the time when we think of gangs. It sure does end in one character being shot to death and two deciding to clean up their act. So I don't know. Is that a happy ending? It I have to say, because like I was an Outsiders kid, right? I read The Outsiders all the time when I was a kid and I watched the movie. And that's what I kept thinking, was that it just made me think of The Outsiders.
I don't think I've seen The Outsiders.
Did you read it? S.E. Hinton. No. I will say part of why I may have been making the connection is like, I think The Outsiders was written sometime in the late 60s. So it was probably inspired by the 50s, Rebel Without a Cause, all of that. But yeah, that was where my brain kept going the entire movie, because it does have a similar, like, you one of your characters gets killed and it's very, very, oh, more than one of the characters gets, oh man, that's right, that's a bummer. Okay. Anyway, doesn't really sound like the kind of movie that would have a curse attached to it, does it?
Not necessarily, but it was such an influential film But sure, I'm not entirely surprised.
Like, but we think about, you know, what are some of the ones we've covered? The Exorcist, Rosemary's Baby, The Omen, Poltergeist, like all of them dealing with the devil or demons or some kind of supernatural something. This is a teen movie.
Well, I know also we haven't covered this, but there is a curse associated with The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
And like, to me, that's similar in the similar vein of Rebel Without a Cause.
Sure.
Because it's not a horror film and it's like an older classic film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I don't know. That could be.
I have Glee on my list of possible curses to cover because that's, people think that TV show's cursed.
That would be a fun one. What an ironic one, man.
I mean, yeah, the thing is that like, it's a downer. Because you look at, I mean, it's a new show. So like all, I mean, new-ish, but it's recent enough.
Contemporary.
It's contemporary enough. Like, yeah. And some of those deaths were, yeah, anyway.
Tangent.
Apologize for a tangent, friends. No, but let's, you know, part of why, okay. Yeah, I'll restate this, sorry. But no, Rebel Without a Cause, it's a teen movie, but a number of the actors in the film died in a tragic and in some cases possibly sinister manner, including all three of the leads.
Oh, dang.
So we're going to unpack this. James Dean, born on February 8th of 1931 in Marion, Indiana, to Winton and Mildred Dean.
Mildred.
His family... Yes, it is my grandmother. I mean, she was, to be fair, she's 102, and she was born about 10 years prior to James Dean. So, yeah. His family moved to L.A. when he was 5. His mother died when he was a kid of cancer. His father sent him to Indiana to be raised by an aunt and uncle. He moved back to California for school, attended Santa Monica Junior College in UCLA while working with James Whitmore's acting workshop. Booked some commercials, did some other film and TV work, and decided, you know, I'm going to head to New York City to become a capital A actor.
Ooh.
Like the cool kids. He got a part actually pretty quickly in a Broadway play called See the Jaguar and quickly became a member of the Actors Studio while continuing to get work in TV and theater.
Cool.
In 1954, he was in the Broadway show The Immoralist, which earned him a screen test for Warner Brothers. And he was cast as Cal Trask in John Steinbeck's East of Eden. Got roles in 4 more TV dramas before booking Rebel Without a Cause. And this was kind of an apt movie for James. He loved cars and motorcycles. He moved back to Hollywood, just living the dream. He is starring in Rebel Without a Cause. He bought his first Porsche and entered it in the Palm Springs road races. He liked to race. He was cast in the movie Giant with Rock Hudson and Elizabeth Taylor. And things are looking good. You know, he is going to be a capital S star. On Friday, September 30th of 1955, before the release of Rebel Without a Cause, he'd recently gotten a new car and he was very excited to race it. So he took it out in preparation of a race. In the car was his mechanic friend, Rolf Wutherich.
What a name.
I don't know if I'm saying that correctly, and I apologize, Rolf. They were being followed by Bill Hickman, a stuntman friend of his. In fact, they all got pulled over and were given speeding tickets because they were going too fast.
Surprise, surprise.
This did not stop them. He was speeding down the highway in Salinas, California, and crashed headlong into a Ford sedan.
Oy.
Killing him instantly after suffering a broken neck, numerous broken bones, and lacerations over his entire body.
Woof.
24 years old.
Oh my God, I didn't realize he was so young.
So young.
I did not realize that.
He was the first actor to receive a... posthumous Academy Award nomination for East of Eden, and the only actor to receive then a second posthumous nomination for Giant, which was released the following year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That's so wild. He died before two of his three major films had been released.
Damn.
Now, all of this is tragic and sad, the way it always is when a young person dies, but particularly a young person who had what looked like a very promising future. But, like, are we already jumping to curse, people? Really? Well, turns out it was not just the movie people look at as being cursed.
Uh-oh.
Because something was up with that car.
But the car is cursed?
And this might have been, honestly, if I had to look at something that probably started planting the seeds, it was the car.
Huh.
So the car that James Dean was driving was a Porsche 550 Spyder, which means very little to me because I'm not a car person, as we learned when I was recounting my encounters with car stealing in Pioneer Square a couple episodes ago. But I read an article on How Stuff Works, and it was apparently one of the fastest cars in the world at the time.
Yeah.
It could hit a top speed of 143 miles an hour, which seems...
excessive.
Excessive. Thank you. It seems excessive, Gabby. They were also made of aluminum.
Boy.
Which is not great at protecting human bodies. The Porsche was named, I know some people name their cars. My brother had a car he named the Highway Donkey.
What?
Yeah. I think it was his first car. It was called the Highway Donkey. Have you ever named your cars?
I think I named a car a while ago. I don't remember what it was.
Do we need to hold a contest on Ghoulish Tendencies, name Gabby's car?
No.
No.
No, not anymore. No. Maybe.
Okay. Okay, you'll think about it.
We need
everyone to tell Gabby that they want to name her car and then present amazing names.
Yeah. Go for it. Go wild.
So this car was named Little Bastard. Which is great. I know. Okay, so, and this to me, I will say, is legitimately kind of chilling. A week before the car crash, Alec Guinness, you know who Alec Guinness is?
No.
Very illustrious career as an actor, but most people know him as Obi-Wan Kenobi in the original Star Wars movies. Yeah.
Yes, I do know who that is. Sorry.
He had an encounter with Dean, and I found a clip of him talking about it in an interview. So we're going to let Sir Alec tell the story.
Yes, I'm so excited.
You also met Dean, didn't you, James?
Well,
Dean?
My very first night in Hollywood, I met James Dean. It was a very, very odd occurrence. I'd arrived off the plane. Those were, you know, took a long time in those days, about 16 hours flight. And I'd been met by Grace Kelly and various people, but I found that I was alone for myself for the evening. And a woman I knew phoned up and said, let me take you out to dinner. And we went to various places, and she was wearing trousers, and they wouldn't let her in any of the smart Hollywood restaurants. Think of it, you know, whatever it was, 1952, 54, something like that. However, we finally went to a little Italian dive, and that was full. And so one got turned away. I said, honestly, I don't mind just a hamburger anyway. I was hungry by then. And then I heard feet running down the street, and it was James Dean. And he said, I was in that restaurant, you couldn't get a table. And my name's James Dean. He said, will you come and join me? So he said, yes, very kind of him. And then going back into the restaurant, he said, oh, before we go in, I must show you something. I've just got a new car. And there in the courtyard of this little restaurant was a, I don't know what the car was, some little silver, very smart thing, all done up in cellophane with a bunch of roses tied to its bonnet. And I said, how fast can you drive in this? He said, oh, I can do 150 in it. And I said, have you driven it? He said, no, I've never been in it at all. And some strange thing came over me, some almost different voice. And I said, look, I won't join your table unless you want me to, but I must say something. Please do not get into that car. Because if you do, and I looked at my watch, and I said, if you get into that car at all, it's now Thursday, whatever the date was, 10 o'clock at night, and by 10 o'clock at night, next Thursday, you'll be dead if you get into that car. I thought, oh, awesome. So we had dinner, we had a charming dinner, and he was dead the following Thursday afternoon in that car.
That's wild.
I know. Like, I, like, even me, who is Skeptic Sally, listening to that, I was like, oh.
Oh, I love that he said it was spooky.
That he said it was spooky. Yeah, well, and just, and he was a little off on the days. Like, James Dean died on a Friday. But he's remembering this years later. So, you know, it, sure. A week later.
Technicality.
He was dead. And I find that just absolutely chilling.
I'm curious if those were like some Jedi mind tricks. You know what I mean?
This is also a good like couple decades before Star Wars existed.
I mean, one can dream, you know?
Sure. But it gets weirder. Because after the accident, the car would be sold. And like, it was a mess, you know, it wasn't drivable. But a Dr. William Estrich, I think that's how you say his name. Sorry if I'm butchering some of these names. He got it at a salvage yard to use for parts. So he put the engine in his Lotus race car and apparently loaned out the transmission and suspension to another doctor who also liked to race, Troy McHenry. So Dr. Estrich would then crash his Lotus at the 1956 Pomona sports race. Now, he survived, but his friend that he lent the parts to crashed into a tree at the same race and died.
Oh, damn.
Yeah.
Okay, that's weird.
Yeah. So the narrative at this point is not that the film was cursed,
but the
car was cursed. Yeah.
I think I believe that the car was cursed. Not gonna lie.
Right. It's like, okay, so, oh, it's going to, this is going to go in a direction that even I could not predict. And I think you are going to be genuinely surprised and delighted / raged. But let me get there. Okay.
Okay.
So the car was sold again to George Barris, who wanted to rebuild the whole thing because that's what you should do with a death car. But the frame was completely totaled.
Sure.
So it was loaned to the National Safety Council and toured around the car shows from 1957 to 1959. And then while it was being stored in Fresno, it caught fire.
What?
So the fire wasn't major. There wasn't a lot of damage, but like still, okay, that's weird.
Wait, but was it like a spontaneous explosion?
There's no, like, I don't think they know what started the fire.
Kim started the fire.
I mean, probably.
The car was cursed, so Kim's gonna cover the car. Kim started the fire. Anyway, sorry, go on.
So other stories popped up, but none of these were ones I could actually confirm. So there was a story about the car falling from a display while at a show in Sacramento, which apparently broke someone's hip. Okay. A thief who tried to steal the steering wheel broke his arm while attempting it. Sure. Then it fell and almost killed a driver who was transporting it. Okay, brother. And even a story about the car disappearing in 1960 while it was on its way to a show. So, okay. The current whereabouts of the car are unknown. And a lot of the later stories, many people think were actually fabricated by George Barris, who is trying to make it more sensational and make kind of a name for himself. And I'm inclined to agree because, again, I could not find actual sources for any of these other stories. Just rumor has it, legend says, and you know how I feel about all those things.
The telephone game.
Mm-hmm. The only traceable part that remains is part of the trans axle, and that was discovered in Massachusetts in March of 2020. It was sold at an auction in 2021 for $387,000, and you want to guess who bought it, Gabby? You want to guess?
Zach Bagans.
Yes!
Really?
Yes!
I was totally joking!
I full on lost my shit when I read that. He wanted to be part of his little museum.
I was totally joking. I wasn't even being serious.
I wish you could have seen, experienced the moment while I'm researching and I'm reading and I'm reading like, oh, okay, so they found a part of it. Let me read about that. Do, 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 do. Oh, it got auctioned. That's cool. Do, 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 do. Oh, somebody bought it. Gets, what? That's my recreation of what my research was like.
I really love the like active narration of your researching.
So that's what I sound like when I research. Yeah. When I'm researching in public, I drive people crazy.
Drinking the wine. Drink the wine.
Have some more wine. Yes.
Just like that.
Just like that.
Zach Bagans, what?
I know.
Oh my God, like, that's so funny.
So if you want, folks, you can go and see this part of a car at Zach Bagans Museum of Wonder
and
Delight.
What year? What year was it purchased, did it say?
It was sold at auction 2021.
Oh, that's so right. Okay. So that's recent.
Pretty recent. Yeah. They only discovered it in 2020 because some of the earlier articles I was reading just referenced it being lost.
I only asked because I went to Zach Bagans, that haunted museum, but that was in 2019.
I was like, that was pre-pandemic, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was pre-pandemic, so it wasn't there yet. So I did not.
One of these
it.
Days, you and I are going to do a ghoulish field trip, and we're going to record live commentary of us going through the museum.
Yeah, and we're just going to go to Vegas for that, turn around and come home, because I freaking hate Las Vegas.
I know, but I like the penny slots, Gabby.
Okay, fine, penny slots. But then we're coming home because I cannot stand Las Vegas.
But I like the penny slots.
Oh my God, Kim. Okay.
They're fun. It's because you get the bonus rounds on things and it dings at you and it's you get to pick things and sometimes they're zombies.
Only if I can shit talk everyone that walks past me.
And absolutely.
All right, cool.
I encourage it. You know I love a good shit talk.
Oh, that's why we're friends.
It's true. Okay. Focus.
Anyway.
So most of the accidents to me are, even though this is utterly bizarre, I will absolutely grant you, all of this is real weird, but it also to me seems less of a curse and more just like car racing's dangerous, man.
If you kept track of every car that someone crashed in, how many times would it be reused because it has a good engine and kill other people? That's what I'm curious about, because like just because James Dean owns this car makes it notable, but like how many other cars were like this? Do you know what I mean?
Specifically, like all of these, every accident it was involved in was a car race.
Yeah.
So again, well,
people
I come
are driving
back to
like fast.
Fast and I mean, there's half people who go to NASCAR aren't going because they like to watch cars race. They're going because they think a car might crash.
Okay. Yep.
I mean, right? The studio no didn't comment. Even. The studio would not let him race while he was actively filming because of his reputation of being a hothead combined with the fact that racing is dangerous.
I mean, that's a smart move. I'm not going to lie. Yeah.
It would be different to me if he just like was in a regular car accident and then
sure.
The car parts kept getting in regular car accidents. But I like.
Yeah.
Statistically, car racing is in the movie Rebel Without a Cause, there is a car race and someone dies. Spoiler alert for a 70-year-old movie.
I'm like, please don't give a spoiler alert. People should know this by now.
But I mean, do you know what I mean? It was a plot point in Rebel Without a Cause. Rebel Without a Cause. Rebel Without a Car.
Rebel Without a Car. That would be a different movie.
Very different movie.
Very slow, because there would be no car in a foot race.
No car. And in fact, okay, the spot where James Dean died is called Blood Alley because of how many crashes have happened around there. From 2000 to 2010, there were 38 fatalities along that stretch of road. And according to an article in the Hollywood Reporter that ran in 2015, in the last decade, so it's referring to 2005 to 2015, 11 crashes happened in almost the exact same spot that James Dean crashed. And 4 people were killed in those 11 crashes.
So is that spot cursed or is it just a dangerous curve?
It's just a dangerous spot. Because cars can be very dangerous too, like when people are reckless.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, so fun side note before we move on to the next part of the curse. The gravesite of James Dean is supposedly haunted by a ghost.
Not James Dean.
No. His, where he was buried. It's supposedly haunted by James Dean.
Oh, by James Dean. Okay, got it. The way you said it made it sound like not his ghost. Did you say his ghost or apologies. A ghost?
I just said, I said haunted by his ghost, but.
Oh, I heard haunted by a ghost. So I thought it was
some random ghost. It's just some like, random guy like a is nice like, place to haunt.
And then I we're going to go into here. A tangent about how it's not always who you think it is.
I mean, to be fair, if anyone was going to go into a tangent, it's probably me. I'm like, Gabby, I'm on page 4 of my notes and I have 15 pages of notes. So
oh my goodness, keep it rolling.
No, so he was buried in Park Cemetery in Fairpoint, Indiana. He smoked. And allegedly, if you bring an unlit cigarette and put it on top of his grave, you go away for a little bit and come back, the cigarette will be lit and you can smell the smoke in the air. Which makes sense because cigarette smoke is stinky.
That does make sense.
Sometimes the cigarette disappears entirely. His spirit is also spotted sitting on his tombstone, and cold spots are often reported around his grave. If we have any listeners in Indiana who want to give this a try, please go and take pictures and let us know if your offering was accepted. At the crash site in California, you can allegedly spot him hitchhiking. If you stop to pick him up, he disappears. PSA, don't stop to pick up hitchhikers, even if the hitchhiker is the ghost of James Dean.
Also, hitchhikers that are alive are scarier than hitchhikers that are dead. Just
very true.
That.
You can pick up all the dead hitchhikers you want. Don't pick up any living ones.
Especially if you're in the haunted mansion.
Especially if you're in the haunted mansion. His car is also sometimes seen driving around. I love a good ghost car. That doesn't play into the curse, but like I couldn't resist throwing in the ghost story at angle. Next on our list is Nick Adams. Now, Nick Adams is one who isn't even always mentioned in The Curse, but then sometimes he is. So I thought, well, let's talk about him. Sure. He didn't have a very big part in Rebel Without a Cause. His character's name was Chick. It's one of the gang members.
Okay.
He became friends with a lot of the cast. He'd go out with them. He became friends with Elvis Presley. Had a lot of bit and supporting parts before finding some success on an ABC series in 1959 called The Rebel. His career declined by the mid to late 60s, and on February 8th of 1968, he was found dead. According to an article that ran in the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, quote, Nick Adams, 36, who won fame as The Rebel on television, was found dead in his Coldwater Canyon home last night under circumstances that puzzled police.
Ooh, what a good title.
His body, fully clothed, was found in a sitting position beside his bed by his attorney, Irvin Tip Roeder. There was no indication as to the cause of death. No weapons or sleeping pills were found. Adams' lawyer told Detective Vern Jones he arrived at the 54,000 Cape Cod-style home bordering Beverly Hills about 8 p.m. When no one answered the doorbell, Roeder crawled through a window and discovered the body. What's even creepier about all this is when his body was found, the eyes were apparently opened and staring.
Oh.
So the autopsy showed that he had taken a huge dose of sedative, which would have been okay if he had not also taken a tranquilizer.
Oh, that'll do it.
That'll do it. Ultimately, the cause of death was listed as accidental, suicidal, and undetermined.
That's a lot of options.
I mean, to be fair, it's covering your base because they don't know. There were some oddities, though, that led some people to believe foul play could have been involved. The fact that the container for the sedative couldn't be found in the house, although they did find a lot of miscellaneous bottles, so who knows what was in there. Irvin Roeder, his attorney who found his body, would be accused decades later of taking money from Nick, but weirdly enough, him and his girlfriend were also murdered in 1981, which is its own ghoulish episode. Like, it got weird. I was, you know, sometimes when you're doing an episode like this where you have to talk about a bunch of things and you start diving into something and you're like, this is way too much to talk about.
We were just talking about this.
We were just talking about this. That's kind of what I discovered when I started looking into their deaths. So stay tuned. We might cover that for a future ghoulish episode.
Cool.
Ultimately, despite our love for looking for murder and everything, I agree this was a case of someone probably taking too much of a drug, either accidentally or on purpose. And it's tragic, but not nefarious.
Agreed. I would agree with you.
But the real question for this episode, does this mean curse?
Curse or no curse?
Curse or no curse? What do you say, Gabby?
I say people shouldn't do that many drugs.
There you go, folks.
No curse.
Our next potential curse victim, and this is another one that is not always talked about, but popped up a couple times, and that was Edward Platt, who played one of the officers in the film. And I best know Edward Platt as playing the chief in Get Smart, which was one of my absolute favorite shows as a kid. In 1974, at the age of 58, he died unexpectedly. It was initially reported that he died of a heart attack, which for a 58-year-old is not that strange. His son would later come out and admit he had died by suicide. He'd apparently suffered from depression for years and had a few possible attempts prior to his death. Sad. Now, this is very sad. Yeah. And I've said this before when we've done curse episodes. I personally get a little riled up when we chalk up someone's mental health struggles to a curse, because I think that's gross.
I would agree.
Now, our next possible curse victim, Sal Mineo. And Sal Mineo was one of the other leads of the film. He played Plato. He was born in 1939 in Harlem, New York. A talent scout encouraged his mom to get him into the arts, so he started taking acting and dance lessons. He was on Broadway in The Rose Tattoo by the time he was 12. He would also appear in The King and I on Broadway. Cool. His career then transitioned to film. He did several movies as a teenager, but his breakout role was Rebel Without a Cause, where he got a supporting actor nomination for.
Cool.
He'd later receive another nomination for his work in the movie Exodus. Now, his star continued to rise. He was doing more and more film roles, even tried his luck as a pop star for a bit.
How fun.
In 1972, he did something that not a lot of actors would do at the time. I mean, not a lot of actors are still doing now. It's getting better, though. He came out as bisexual.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Some people say he was gay, and he used the label as bisexual to be more palatable, which is possible, sure, but also, thank you, bi erasure.
Yeah.
Something I always get a little bit pissy about when people say, well, they weren't really bisexual. How do you know? He had serious relationships with both men and women, so... Now, the switch from teen roles to adult was not the easiest. He did find some parts as he got older, did some TV work, as well as return to the stage. Mm-hmm. He was acting in a play called P.S. Your Cat is Dead.
What?
Yeah, that was not a play I'd heard of before. You can bet your ass as soon as I read about it, I ordered it on Amazon. I'll let you know what I think.
What a title.
On February 12th of 1976, he was on his way home from rehearsal in L.A. He was parking his car behind his apartment building when he was attacked and stabbed.
Oh, no.
His neighbors would hear him calling for help and see a man with brown hair running away from the scene. He didn't even live long enough for the police to arrive.
Oh, that's awful.
He was 37 years old.
Oh, I hate that.
An autopsy would show he died of a single stab wound to the heart. He still had $21 in his pocket, which made police think that it was not a robbery. They were stumped, though. They couldn't figure out a motive. He had done some work for prison reform that put him in contact with an ex-con. So they're like, oh, maybe that had something to do with it, but that went nowhere. It was known that he used some recreational drugs, marijuana, cocaine. So they thought, well, maybe it was some kind of drug deal gone bad. Then they found pictures of nude men in his home, as well as leather pants, which led the investigators to think maybe it had something to do with that. Like it was a gay murder, which wasn't great for how the public started viewing the case. 2 years would go by before they got a formal break. Now, a woman would come forward and recalled when she had been living in Los Angeles with her husband at the time. He came home one night with blood all over him, and it was the night of Sal Mineo's murder. She said her husband told her he had killed Sal Mineo during an attempt to rob him. However, shortly after she told police this, she died by suicide.
Oh, no.
Her husband's name was Lionel Williams. He was currently in custody for writing bad checks. He was questioned. He made up a story about overhearing gang members saying they had wanted Sal dead because of a bad drug deal. But while serving time in Michigan, he started bragging that he had killed Sal Mineo a couple years prior, and that was enough to finally charge him. Now, he would be convicted in Mineo's murder, sentenced to life in prison. There are those who still think there was some kind of conspiracy theory around his death, but it looks like Williams was robbing Mineo, and it was just wrong place, wrong time.
Ugh.
Michael Greg Michaud, who wrote Sal Mineo, a biography, was quoted as saying, "There are people who still question his death. Even to this day, people still question his death. There are still people on social media who contact me and ask, wasn't this a sex killing? It never seems to go away." However, he would go on to say about Williams, "Didn't even know who he was. He had been on a crime spree for a week or 10 days before. This was the first time anyone was fatally injured. Sal cried out for help when he saw this guy approach him. Williams had a knife and stabbed him, probably not meaning to kill him, but just to shut him up. The stab was fatal. There's no doubt he killed him, but still today, some people questioned it." I did try to find out if Lionel Williams was still living today, just mostly out of curiosity. I found an article referencing him being alive as of 2020. Mm-hmm. I could not find a source on that information. Mm-hmm. So, again, that was just mostly Kim is curious about details.
Fair.
What do you think, Gabby? Curse or no curse?
No curse.
No curse. I love how quickly you pulled that out. How things have
changed.
Welcome.
Oh, we've been doing this a long time now.
We have been. Okay. This brings us to the one that I personally find to be the most strange. In fact, this is one that's been on my list to do an episode on all by itself. And that is the death of Natalie Wood.
Oh.
Do you know, how much do you know about her death? It's been published. There's been some stuff the last couple of years. So,
I know, didn't she die on a boat?
Mm-hmm.
Like she drowned, right?
Mm-hmm. She did.
And there was someone else famous on board.
There's a couple of famous people on board.
Yeah. Well, I forgot who it was, but I know that it was a really controversial case.
Oh, and prepare to get your mind blown.
I know like very vague surface things. So feel free to blow the mind.
So Natalie Wood was born on July 20th of 1938. She appeared in her first Hollywood film at age 4 in a non-speaking part. At the age of 8, she starred in the 1947 Christmas film Miracle on 34th Street as Susan Walker. She was 16 when she starred in Rebel Without a Cause. By 25, she was Maria in West Side Story. Like, girl's a star.
Yeah.
She married actor Robert Wagner for the first time in 1957. She would have been, they met when she was 18. They got married when she was 19. He would have been about 27. So I know it's the 50s, but like.
Still.
Yeah. Yeah. By 1962, they divorced, partially due to some untrue rumors of an affair on Wood's side. According to Suzanne Finstead, who wrote a biography and a number of articles on Natalie Wood, quote, "I was told by 3 of Natalie's close friends, by her mother's best friend and her sister Lana, that Natalie came upon RJ in their Beverly Hills mansion in flagrante with a man. Lana recalled Natalie's arriving in hysterics at their parents' house, her hand bleeding and shutting herself in her old bedroom. Natalie woke up in a hospital dazed and in shock after taking an overdose of sleeping pills and going into a coma."
Oh, damn.
She married Richard Gregson in 1969. I had a daughter with him, but they would divorce in 1972. And 3 months after their divorce, she remarried Robert Wagner. They'd go on to have their own child together. She slowed down her acting to take care of her kids. On Saturday, November 28th of 1981, Natalie, Robert, and their friend, Christopher Walken.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Were out on their boat, the Splendor. Also on board was the boat's captain, Dennis Davern. Walken and Wood were working on a movie together. They all had dinner and drinks at Doug's Harbor Restaurant until about 10:30 at night before going back to the boat. The night manager at the restaurant would later comment he felt all 4 of them were intoxicated. After returning to the boat, Christopher Walken and Robert Wagner got into an argument. Accounts of Natalie's whereabouts differ. Now, some state that she was there and she went down to the state's room to sleep. Others say she was not present when the argument began. At some point, she went out on deck. Wagner, by around 11:05, realized she wasn't in the stateroom and said that he went to look for her. He went up on deck, didn't see her, and he realized a dinghy was missing. This is where the time gets a little funky to me. Because he first contacts Harbor Patrol at 1:30 a.m. And the Coast Guard were not contacted until about 3:30 a.m.
That's odd.
It's a lot of hours to go by.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a boat. it's a yacht. It's a decent sized boat. But it's a boat. It does not take you 2.5 hours to look for one person on a boat.
You can only look in so many places.
Only so many places to look. So they found the dinghy. They couldn't find her. A little before dawn, a man named Doug Bommard was contacted for help. He followed the kelp line and at about 7:44 a.m. spotted a red object, which would turn out to be Natalie's jacket. She was dead at 43 years old.
So sad.
She's wearing a flannel nightgown, and her jacket had filled with water, making it weigh about 40 pounds.
Oh, my God.
The autopsy report would list the death as an accidental drowning, stating she had gotten into the dinghy to get away from the arguing men. It would note that she had a number of bruises and scratches on her. Now, the coroner initially said it was consistent with falling overboard. However, 2 years later, the coroner changed this. He believed that Wood had had a few drinks. Her blood alcohol level was 0.14 when she died. That is on the higher side. And that the dinghy was hitting the side and it was keeping her awake. She tried to stop it and fell into the water where she drowned. Natalie Wood was not a good swimmer. In a strange twist of fate, her sister Lana would later reveal that a psychic had warned their mother that someone in her family would die by drowning.
Huh.
Her mother used to tell the girls this story, which would terrify Natalie. Natalie would tell the New York Times, I've always been terrified, still am, of water, dark water, seawater. It's kind of weird that we have two death premonitions in this episode.
Yeah, man.
In 1997, Christopher Walken spoke about that evening for the first time in an interview with Playboy magazine.
What? Are you serious? Yeah.
Well, Playboy magazine used to be like, you know, a lot of the actors did interviews and did spreads and stuff.
But this is the first time he talks about it. That's wild.
Formally, yes. Huh. I mean, he spoke to the police, obviously, when it happened, but he was very, very quiet on the subject.
Okay.
Anybody there saw the logistics of the boat, the night, where we were, that it was raining, and would know exactly what happened. You hear about things happening to people. They slip in the bathtub, fall down the stairs, step off the curb in London because they think that the car has come the other way, and they die. You feel you want to die making an effort at something. You don't want to die in some unnecessary way. What happened that night, only she knows because she was alone. She had gone to bed before us, and her room was at the back. A dinghy was bouncing against the side of the boat, and I think she went out to move it. There was a ski ramp that was partially in the water. It was slippery. I'd walked on it myself. She had told me she couldn't swim. In fact, they had to cut a swimming scene from the movie they were working on, Brainstorm. She was probably half asleep, and she was wearing a coat. Okay, so that matches the initial theory about what happened. However... In 2011, the case was reopened because new sources are coming forward. One of those sources, the captain. Davern came forward and said he lied when he was questioned and that Robert Wagner was responsible for her death. Later saying, quote, I just didn't want my whole life to go by without having the truth come out. In 2013, the cause of death was changed to drowning and undetermined factors, partially because of the scratches and bruising, which could have happened before she drowned. In fact, one of the investigators looking into the case currently was quoted as saying that the bruises looked suspicious because, quote, she looked like the victim of an assault.
Ooh.
Natalie had also not operated one of the dinghies on her own. So the idea that she would go in one, which was the original excuse given, seemed absolutely bonkers. So since reopening the investigation, other details have emerged about the couple's marriage. One man, a former neighbor, recalled a time during their first marriage when he was 12, and she came to his house banging on the door. Quote, she was so afraid of him. She ran to a neighbor's house yelling, he's going to kill me, and looking for help and looking for safety. And so a neighbor took her in. At the time of her death, there were rumors, as there often are between co-stars, but that Wood and Walken were having an affair. Hmm. Another witness on a nearby boat would come forward to say that Wood and Wagner argued the night before she died, something Captain Davern would later back up. Wagner wanted to move the boat, and she didn't think it was safe. She asked Davern to take her to shore on the dinghy, and according to him, spent a lot of the evening crying about the problems in her marriage. Wagner was jealous, and she was over it. She was thinking of leaving him.
Ooh.
The next day at the restaurant, things were tense, and Natalie was paying attention to Christopher Walken and not her husband.
Uh-oh.
According to Davern, once they were back at the boat, things got really heated. Quote, Natalie and Christopher continued to giggle, just having fun. And then Robert Wagner, out of the clear blue, picked up the bottle of wine and smashed it.
Oh, shoot.
He then allegedly yelled at Walken, what are you trying to do? Fuck my wife? Natalie says she can't take this. She leaves the room. According to Davern, Walken went to his room and Robert and Natalie fought, like throwing things fought. Now, Davern says that he hears them arguing and he's hearing things knocking about and he's worried. So he knocks on their door to check on them and Wagner tells him to go away. He hears the fight continuing and it continues to the back of the boat. And then two more witnesses would come forward reporting seeing figures, a man and a woman, arguing on the back of the boat. And they reported that they also heard the argument just stop.
Oh, that's not good.
Like complete silence.
Did they hear a splash?
Not that was reported.
Okay. Figured I'd ask.
Davern would say that about 10 minutes after the fight stopped, he went down and found Wagner in the stateroom crying, saying that Natalie is missing.
Oh, that's convenient.
He tells Davern to search the boat, and when he doesn't find anything, he goes back to Wagner, and suddenly the dinghy is missing as well. He says that Wagner is the one telling him not to call for help and not to turn on the searchlight. She probably took the boat to town. And they should wait for her to come back, which Davern at the time was like, no, I'm the one that drives her on the dinghy. She is afraid of operating it. She does not know how to operate it.
Hmm.
Don't be suspicious. In 2018, Robert Wagner was officially named a person of interest in her death. He continues to say he had nothing to do with her death. He is currently 94 years old.
Damn.
Christopher Walken was asked in 2012 about the case and said, quote, I stopped talking about that 30 years ago, and there's so much information, books, and internet. Anything you want to know, just go look.
Oh, damn.
Now, I mentioned author Suzanne Finsted earlier. She has a number of bombshells she's been dropping in her research. In an article for Vanity Fair, she wrote about a confidential source she has that she put in contact with the LA Sheriff's Office. This is a quote from the article. The source had information that Christopher Walken said he heard the fight between RJ and Natalie, and that he told a friend not long after Natalie drowned that Wagner pushed her. Lana once asked Hernandez and Kevin Lowe, the two lead investigators, about Walken's new statement. Ralph said the only way Chris had talked to them is if it was never disclosed. After they spoke with him, they told me they had enough to charge RJ. So, you can kind of see why this would be its own episode.
Yeah, for sure.
And there's so many other pieces that I am, like, not even talking about. If you want to do your own deep dive, like, this case is fascinating. Suzanne Finsted's book, Natalie Wood, The Complete Biography, check it out. It has all of this information, information from her sister, everything.
Damn.
So what happened? Did she accidentally drown? Could she have slipped and fallen in the water? Did Wagner know? Was it intentional? And because it's an episode about a curse, was it the curse?
Not a curse, just a shitty dude. I feel like that should be like the theme.
I don't think...
Not the curse, but a car. The car did it.
The car did it. I will say, I don't think this was premeditated. I think they were fighting, and
yeah, no, I agree.
I don't know if he pushed her and she fell in, or hit her and she hit her head and he panicked and dropped her in the water.
Yeah.
I don't think it was something he set out to do, but I absolutely think he is in some way responsible for her death.
I would agree with you there.
Now, what I find kind of funny is that we're talking about deaths, right? Which, okay, like, given this movie is almost 7 years old, people are going to die.
People are going to die.
Yeah, people are going to die. And same for James Dean, who died before the film was released. The other deaths all happened over a decade or more after the movie came out. Like, Nick Adams was 1968, so that's what, 13 years. Edward Platt, 1974, that's about 19 years. Mm-hmm. Sal was 76, 21 years. Natalie Wood was 81, 26 years. And people do eventually die. But, like, it would be stupid to go through the entire cast of Rebel Without a Cause to see who's alive and who's dead. So, of course, I did just that. Thank you, Wikipedia. Brace yourself. Jim Backus, who played Frank, died in 1989. Ann Doran, who played Carol, died in 2000. Corey Allen, who played Buzz, died in 2010. William Hopper, who played Judy's father, died in 1970. Rochelle Hudson, who played Judy's mother, died in 1972. Marietta Canty, who played the Crawfords family maid, died in 1986. Virginia Brissac, who played Grandma Stark, died in 1979. Dennis Hopper, who played Goon, died in 2010. Jack Grenache, who played Moose, is still alive. 93, living in L.A. Good for you, Jack. Frank Mazzola, who played Crunch, died in 2015. Ian Wolfe, who played Dr. Mitten, died in 1992. Beverly Long, who played Helen, died in 2014. Robert Fulk, who played Gene, died in 1989. Tom Bernard, who played Harry, died in 2018. Steffi Sidney, who played Mill, died in 2010. Clifford Morris, who played Cliff, died in 2017. Not just them, though. The director, Nicholas Ray, died in 1979. Screenwriter, producer, cinematographer, editor, composer. They're all dead, Gabby. I take it back. It must be cursed.
It's just an old movie, man.
It's just an old movie. I mean, at some point, you have to kind of, like, say, there's a time limit on what we can call, like,
cursed. Yeah.
Like, to me, if we're being honest, I think anything that happened, like, let's say within 5 years.
Sure.
Like, give it a 5-year window. So if we're looking at 5 years from this movie, James Dean is the only one. It's also weird to me because, like, everything else we've looked at in the curse category is not just been deaths. Like, there's been, you know, the onset accidents, the lightning strikes, heart attacks. Yeah. Accidents, just things that you're like, okay, yeah, someone's plane being struck by lightning. Sure. Talking about the devil and my plane struck by lightning. Yeah, it's kind of weird. At what point are you just like, people get old and die?
It's a great question.
Well, I wish I was better at statistics. I would love for someone to sit down, do some statistics for like old Hollywood. Because scandals were different then. Drug use was different then. The culture was different then. I would love to see statistics on stars and starlets and how/when they died. Because, like, you know, Marilyn Monroe. There's more. I just don't know why I globbed onto her as being another one of just, like tragic, untimely death. And I mean, again, to be fair, all three of the leads died before they hit the age of 45.
That is weird. Not a curse.
Yes, but I come back to the, give me some statistics about old Hollywood. Do we have, if we have any math happy listeners who want to take this
that's
on?
Not me.
Yeah, it's not me either.
Not me.
But this whole one, it was interesting. Like these were, it was interesting learning about some of these actors. The car, it was maybe for me the weirdest thing. Like, yeah the car seems kind of
sketch.
But I think we took James Dean's kind of untimely death and the weirdness with the car. And I think globbed onto this idea when a few of the other actors died. Again, like a decade later, that it might be related. And I get it. Sometimes it's kind of fun to look at something and think there's a curse. But also, these are all, I don't know, all these deaths are so sad.
I mean, all of them are sad in general, but I feel like when you look at a movie that's this mm-hmm. well known and that has tragedy already attached to it in like one capacity
mm-hmm.
with a main character that died the way that he died, James Dean, obviously, is who I'm talking about. Yeah. It's easy to look at other things and tie it to it in mm-hmm. similar ways as like other curses that we've talked about, where it's mm-hmm. like, you want to attach things because it sounds like it would go together. But then when you look at the details, you're like, but is it just life?
But do they?
But do they? I don't know. I feel like it's a stretch. I think there are some like outstanding messed up things that happened.
Oh, absolutely.
Sure. But I also think there should be like a period of time that you should be like, no, that's not a curse. That's just an old person dying. Like,
I like the five years. You got 5 years.
This, what is it? Statute of limitations to a curse?
Statute of limitations to a curse. 5 years.
5 years.
Yep. Boom.
Done.
But that is the curse of Rebel Without a Cause, as well as a list of the cast and what year they died. You're welcome, everyone.
Well done. Slow clap.
Thank you.
I really appreciate that. Thank you so much, Ken. That was a fun time. And this brings us to Creepy Critics Corner. Creepy Critics Corner. Kim, what you watching?
I've been watching things, Gabby.
All the things.
So I went and saw Late Night with the Devil.
Ooh, how was it?
Currently my top horror of the year.
Oh, wow. That says a lot.
I loved it. I absolutely loved it. Premise of it is this late night host in the 70s, and it's Halloween night, and he has these guests on, and one of the guests is a psychiatrist who has a girl who says she is possessed by a demon, and they kind of contact the demon in the, like, it's part, like, because you're watching the actual episode's footage, mm-hmm. but then you're watching behind the scenes video from when they go to commercial break. So it's kind of a found footage-y in a 1970s Ooh, style.
Cool.
Very, very, like, it just kind of nails a very specific style. I loved it. The lead actor is so good. I thought it was a blast. It's going to be streaming on Shudder, I think, by the end of the month. So if you don't have a chance to see it in theaters, which I do recommend if you're able, but it'll be streaming soon.
Nice.
I went and saw Immaculate, which is another, there's a lot of like devil pregnancies because the first Omen comes out soon as well.
How fun.
But this is the Sydney Sweeney movie.
Oh,
I gotta say, I was not expecting to enjoy it as much as I did.
Nice.
Bob, our friend Bob, had spoken very highly of it. And so I thought, all right, I'll go give it a shot. I was kind of planning to maybe wait till this one was streaming, but it's so messed up, but messed up in like a really pleasing way. Nice. If you are a devout Catholic, I do not recommend watching this movie. It's I don't know if sacrilegious is the right word, but like, it goes there. It's about a young woman, a young novice, a nun, mm-hmm. American, and she goes to a convent in Italy, and the convent like takes care of older nuns, but there's some weird stuff going on, and then suddenly she's pregnant.
What?
Which doesn't usually happen without the sex.
Especially with old nuns.
Well, no, she's not an old nun.
No, but she's with old nuns. So,
oh, yeah, like, but there's also priests and stuff.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
but like, the, you know, they one of the plot points is like, you know, they gave her a medical examination. She was totes a virgin. Hence the title Immaculate. And shenanigans follow. It has a very, like, Italian horror vibe to it. Nice. And reminded me a little bit with some of the beats of Suspiria.
Cool.
But it was, man, it was great. It's messed up. It's messed up. It's not necessarily a movie everyone's going to like, but I thought it was a hoot. Really fun.
A little way to describe it.
It's got some gross moments in it too. So like not like gratuitously violent, but also when it goes there, it goes there.
Does not hesitate.
It does not, like, you see bones broken, you see faces smashed in, you see stuff getting cut into. Yeah, again, it is not a horror film for everyone. But I thought it was a damn good time.
All right. Nice. That sounds good. I'd watch that.
It was, I very much enjoyed it. What you been watching?
I have been watching all the documentary true crime-ish things. I watched American Nightmare. Did I talk about that in another episode? I may have talked about American Nightmare in a previous episode, so I apologize if I did. Was very good. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It's on Netflix. But I think one of the things that I'm really enjoying about my master's program is some of the homework I have is to watch Netflix shows that I might not have found unless it was suggested to me. So I watched for homework a couple of episodes of The Innocence Files, which basically talks about people that were unjustly convicted of crimes, served time, and then later were proven to be innocent. And one of the main episodes that I watched episodes 4 and 5 for my class, talking about a drive-by shooting where an innocent person was convicted. And it was all due to eyewitness testimony not being reliable due to inconsistencies in memory and influence of investigators and detectives and the way that they're questioned. And are they giving leading questions? Are like, what was the timeline in which someone was asked questions? How many people did they look at in a lineup? And did they know these people in advance already? And was it even bright enough for them to see someone's face in a car? Like, some of the details were just wild. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why I'm still surprised that this happens as often as it does, that innocent people are tried and convicted with like not even the most sustainable evidence. Especially like in that weird period of time, I'd say like from the 90s to the early 2000s, where like a lot of technology was just starting to be used, but certain parts of the US didn't have access to it, depending on like where we're talking. Is it a city or a like remote area? You know what I mean? So just really fascinating stuff. And I'm still constantly like, my mind is constantly blown by it. So it's great docuseries. And then I also started a docuseries that's actually new on Max, on HBO, called Justice USA. And it takes place in Nashville, and it follows certain people that are somehow incarcerated. It starts from how they became incarcerated, if they were justly or not justly incarcerated, what processes they have to go through. And it's HBO style documentary. So it's really well done. And it follows every episode follow certain people, and then you see updates on them throughout the episodes, and it's actively a new show. So I think there's 5 episodes out that I've seen so far. I think there's a 6th that might have come out since it released, but I've just been going down a rabbit hole of all of this stuff because of what I'm studying, and it's just fascinating to me, and also just sad, like how divided and racist the criminal justice system is, and how unfair a lot of it is, when you would think that if you're talking about justice, why is it so unfair? It seems ironic. But anyway, that's what I've been watching and just reading for homework. So that stuff's not fun to talk about. But yeah, that's what I've been watching lately. Just lots of true crimey stuff. Also the trash TV, but I'll spare you.
you love your trash TV.
You know, I'm two polar opposite ends of the spectrum, either really serious and sad or something super dumb. Like, I, anything that's in the middle, I have to like really reserve the time for.
That's fair.
So anywho, that's what I've been watching. But thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you, Kim. I need to give a shout out to my dear friend, Kim Douthit, for just really last minute taking this episode by the reins and helping me out and covering a topic. So I'll do the next one, I promise. But thank you, Kim. I love you. I appreciate you so much. And that was a very fun topic.
Yay, I'm glad.
Yay. Anywho, thanks for listening. If you like what we do, head on over to Patreon. Give us your money, please. We also, if you like what we do and don't want to do that, you can just leave a review or a rating on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. You can find us anywhere on social medias as Ghoulish Tendencies Podcast. And tell your friends, tell your fam. We like to find our niche groups of peeps. And having said that, thank you so much for listening. And
stay spooky.